Author's note. Ellie did get COVID. She was dreadfully sick, recovered, and rolled up her sleeves again. In reality, I ended up in a role with UN Women, though the 2020 64th annual session of the UN Commission on the Status of Women in New York City was canceled in light of COVID-19. In lieu of its usual 10 days of programming at UN headquarters, it convened for a procedural meeting on March 9th, 2020. Speaking of what really happened versus what didn't, let's get the most burning question out of the way. How much of this story is true? Short answer, most of it, either specifically or generally. While remastering the 1919 unpublished manuscript of my great-great-grandfather, George Francis Ellis, I was awestruck on a couple of counts. First, by his amazing feats and exploits, which he survived against mind-boggling odds. He really was on a train with General Custer and really did see Buffalo Bill on the frontier. In 1896, he did go to Alaska on business for the North American Transportation and Trading Company when the gold mines at Dawson were first being discovered, well ahead of widespread knowledge of the mines. His previous experience in mining and speculation enabled him to choose and trade for claims that resulted in a great fortune. It is true that claims number 12 and 13 on El Dorado Creek proved to be very valuable and, for a time, yielded $10,000 every 24 hours, producing an immense fortune. George F. Ellis was so successful that Joaquin Miller, in his letters from Alaska, refers to him as the Monte Cristo of the Klondike. As it goes with epic stories of the Old West, the fortune was later lost in other business ventures that went bust. Second, I noticed the paucity of women in his otherwise Dumas-esque life and adventures. His story is nothing short of spectacular, and he was also a white man operating in a white man's world. Tracking whenever a woman or non-white was mentioned in his mess of an otherwise thrilling sheaf, I noted what a limited lens his story represented, notwithstanding the stunning details. I yearned to see more stories of women and indigenous people hidden behind the old courier typeset. Based on breadcrumbs George F. Ellis drops of women characters in particular, I managed to track them, or a facsimile, down and their own rich, careening backstories, not to mention that of my transcendent great-great-grandmother, whose name and biography is not even mentioned in the manuscript, but known through other means. It is true that some women disguised as men to mine for gold and that laws emerged banning people from dressing outside their gender. For example, in San Francisco in 1863 law made it a misdemeanor for a person to appear in public in, quote, a dress not belonging to his or her sex, unquote. Mrs. Bowers, the San Francisco fortune teller? Real. As is Ellie's tarot card reading, reflecting my own. And she did accurately foresee my great-great-grandfather's fortune. In real life, he abstained from the voyage she predicted would lead to his demise, and that ship and everyone aboard was lost, never heard from again. The Chicago counterfeiter Mrs. Joubert, P.B. Weir, Elizabeth Ashe, Alice Griffith, Lily Hitchcock Coit, all real. Elizabeth, born 1869, Teddy's junior by 15 years, became a community activist in her teens while teaching Sunday school at Grace Church, now Grace Cathedral, in the post-fire location. She got to know her neighbors from Telegraph Hill, mostly Irish, Italian, German, and Latin American immigrants who frequently lived in overcrowded, unsanitary conditions without heat or plumbing. Born to privilege, Elizabeth was concerned about those communities and the number of unsupervised and sometimes working children. When epidemics of diphtheria, tuberculosis, whooping cough, and typhoid fever broke out, she and her friend Alice Griffith, born in 1868, established the city's first settlement house in 1890, an organization designed to assist struggling families with health care, daycare, and education. Lily Firebell Lil Coit, born 1843, Teddy's senior by 11 years, was considered eccentric, smoking cigars and wearing trousers long before it was socially acceptable for women to do so. She was an avid gambler and often dressed like a man in order to gamble in the male-only establishments that dotted North Beach, and had her own dramatic scene play out at the Palace Hotel in 1903. She was a well-known supporter of firefighters in the city, having been made an honorary member of Knickerbocker Engine Company No. 5 as a teenager. Her legacy and the design of Coit Tower, built in 1933, have become intertwined with the city's firefighting history, while the Art Deco-style tower resembling a fire hose nozzle, even if the resemblance wasn't the primary design intention of its architects, I should have said, had become intertwined with the city's firefighting history with the Art Deco style tower resembling a fire hose nozzle, even though that wasn't the intention. It's actually, it's kind of just a coincidence. People talk about how it was designed to look like a fire hose nozzle. I was actually once, this isn't in the author's note, I'm just talking to you now. I was actually once a North Beach tour guide, and it's not actually true that it was designed to be that way, but it does look like a fire hose nozzle. Okay, back to the author's note. And of course, Amedeo Pietro Giannini was instrumental in rebuilding San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake and fire, and founded Bank of America. Fun fact, my boys attended AP Giannini Middle School in San Francisco. Given that George wrote the manuscript the same year that U.S. Congress passed the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote, George was not a fan of suffrage. And given that his exploits took place during the Industrial Revolution, the single most significant contributor to the precipitous advancement of women's participation in education, economics, and society in all of human history, and given the present-day correlation of women's rights deteriorating along with climate crisis and the depletion of the cheap and abundant energy sources that have made them possible, I felt an imperative to bring to the surface the untold stories through the lens of my great-great-grandmother on the American frontier, and ending up in San Francisco, where I, an attorney, UN Women Vice President Emerita, law professor, and special needs mother and advocate, have called home my entire adult life. As for Ellie's clients, all real, names altered. Fernanda Salinas's case represents many Fernandas I assisted who migrated from Mexico to the United States due to unlivable conditions. Hansa's Hindi with the Bindi case. The red pushpin photo in an otherwise administrative workplace injury case was real. When I presented this smoking gun evidence to my client, she reacted just as Hansa did. Clients, even with confidentiality, often don't share humiliating details, not even with their lawyers. Plus, it was too illogical to be meaningful in her mind. The real Hansa didn't want to subject herself to a lawsuit, despite the rare smoking gun. She was scared and embarrassed, so we settled in an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, mediation. Bita Masudi was similarly frightened and circumspect. Aggression towards women often manifests subtly. While in her home country, Bita may have faced a brutal beating for an improperly donned hijab. In the U.S., her oppressor was a bit less menacing. Ellie's situation as the divorced mother of two young boys, three including Bravo the Black Labrador, one with special needs and a team of 14 interventionists, accurately reflects my life, including the trips to the UC Davis Mind Institute, as does her wrongful termination case, which happened to me. Every word and deed attributed to the fictionally named Hutton and Fetterer law firm and characters is directly sourced from my real-life work experience, including timesheet gate and the email that I couldn't possibly, quote, toe the line with a special needs kid, which I remember vividly because toe, T-O-E, was misspelled as toe, T-O-W. I was fired from my job as an attorney by attorneys because of my son with disabilities, and it actually was a New York Times Magazine cover story on caregiver discrimination. At the time, it was a disability association discrimination, not very common, retaliation and gender-based discrimination case, as caregiver status was not yet a workplace protected category. My case, among a few others, was presented to the EEOC, resulting in official agency guidelines on caregiver discrimination and, eventually, legislation, though that chain of events unfolded about a dozen years before the 2019 timeframe here. I don't think I would have marshaled the courage to pursue litigation and go public with my situation had I not been championed by the real Ruby Martinez, the director of the Center for Work-Life Law at UC College of the Law, San Francisco, renamed from UC Hastings in 2022 due to Serranus Hastings' involvement in Native American genocide, where I also taught, as well as UC Berkeley Law, The employer, not the fictional firm depicted here, that fired me was powerful and daunting. They had knocked me down, and I thought I should just stay down. Ruby recognized a much bigger picture and other women who were not in a position to speak up. And I was a clinic student myself during law school in the workers' rights clinic, then spent years as a volunteer supervising attorney for the clinic once I had my law license. My Italian family roots do reach back to early days of San Francisco and North Beach, and Coit Tower is probably my favorite spot in all of San Francisco. Ellie's flat and the five-unit building on Greenwich Street just at the base of Coit Tower was built by Julius Martinelli and commissioned by Albert Petsy for his multi-generational family and completed in 1913. It's still there today and, as of this writing, still owned by the Petsy family. The Giraudo family, owners of Boudin Bakery, established in 1849, bought by Stephen Giraudo in 1941, were family friends of ours, and sourdough starter was a staple for miners. A fond childhood memory is of Lou Giraudo visiting us in Chicago to open the Boudin Bakery in the downtown Water Tower Place. He handed me and my brother, Mark, our own fresh sourdough loaves, and we walked around the mall, scooping out the soft center. As an adult, clerking for a law firm at 4 Embarcadero Center one summer during law school, I did stop each morning at the Boudin Bakery at the lobby level for a sourdough English muffin. You know, back when I ate carbs. Later in life, I met my husband, Francesco, at the original Boudin location. In 1994, I volunteered at the Olampoli State Park in Marin County, California, braiding tule reed for the construction of new huts called cochas for a replica Miwok village. When I returned to Olampoli in 2024 as part of my research for this book, the tule cochas were gone and the park and village largely forgotten. The visitor center was no longer even open on weekdays, the picnic tables rotted, and most of the historical information signs unreadable from weather and neglect, partly attributable to mudslides. Perhaps this book could spur a revitalization of the park and the Miwok Village, not as a historical site on one of the Native American people of California, but, quote, with, for, and by them. They are still here. The Miwok and so many other tribes were nearly obliterated, not entirely. The myth of extinction, as put by Coast Miwok and UC Berkeley professor Peter Nelson, is harmful for ongoing existing cultures of California Indian people. Quote, portraying us as broken, divorced, and relocated from our history and knowledge, unquote. Professor Nelson asks that, quote, our many colleagues, mentors, supporters, co-conspirators, allies, and accomplices join us in collaborative projects and in celebrating the empowerment, health, and well-being of our communities, unquote. Then there was the day, witnessed by my development editor, Nicola. Combing through the large box of my family's artifacts, photos, and letters, I actually discovered a carefully swaddled, monogrammed hat pin that belonged to my own Teddy, my great-great-grandmother. It gave me chills, as if she really was whispering to me in the hushed and raspy tones of a century-old voice, like a campfire keeping ablaze to tell me something. As for Mrs. O'Leary's cow, Mrs. Catherine, and notice she was blamed, not her husband Patrick, despite how unusual it was in 1871 for a woman to own property, chercher la femme, O'Leary's cow did not cause the Great Chicago Fire, cue widespread anti-Irish immigrant sentiment, as chronicled by my great-great-grandfather's presence in Chicago doing business for P.B. Weir. Many theories of its cause abounded at the time and since, yet the legend of Mrs. O'Leary's cow is the one that stuck for over a century, and the fire's origin was in the vicinity of the O'Leary barn. The most likely cause for the destruction, based on meteorological data from that week in 1871, is a meteor shower and wind patterns carrying embers across Lake Michigan to the dry conditions in Chicago, caused by persistent wind, along with other smaller fires in Michigan that same night. Besides, as noted by Teddy, who milks a cow at 9 p.m., which is when the fire broke out? Growing up in a small town outside of Chicago, Mrs. O'Leary's cow was what we were taught in school. Not until 1997 was the O'Leary name cleared, though the cow was exonerated 11 years earlier in 1986. No joke. At any rate, the fire left him, quote, broke and in debt to PB about $3,000, unquote. So, we women were nothing but trouble when all was said and done. Some things never change. As Jane Goodall aptly put it, it actually doesn't take much to be considered a difficult woman. That's why there are so many of us.